What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Welcome to my neighborhood, the Avenue. I grew up here, and each week I'll be sharing the sounds and stories of the people that made the Avenue great. Welcome back to the Avenue. This is the final episode in our two-part series with Claudia Pauly. On last week's show, we discussed Claudia's work as a classical music vocalist and a French disco star. Claudia also shared her family's extensive history in the Indiana Avenue neighborhood. This week, we'll cover Claudia's time as a broadcaster and discuss her work producing jazz and blues music for Maple Shade Records. We'll also talk about her current role as president of the Urban Legacy Lands Initiative, an organization dedicated to preserving the history of Indiana Avenue and other historic black spaces in Indiana. Let's start this week's show with a classic disco single Claudia recorded during her time in France. From 1977, this is C'est la vie. That was Claudia Pauly with her 1977 single, C'est la vie. And Claudia Pauly is our guest this week. She recently spoke with WFYI's Kyle Long. Let's join their conversation as Claudia discusses her extraordinary work in broadcasting.
And Claudia, what was your time in France? Did you go into this thinking you were going to move there permanently? Was it just a brief kind of work trip? How did you view that?
Well, I thought it was a brief kind of work trip, although I took all the important stuff that I owned. And it turned into 4 years. And then I went back for another 3.5 years, a few years after that. So it just led to, it felt good. It felt right. I should have probably stayed in New York because turns out my then friend, still a friend, Andrew Young, Ambassador Young, was looking for me to hire me to go to work at the UN in his new staff as a press person, but I never got that memo, so I stayed in Paris.
And Claudia, you mentioned the initial sort of reason for you to travel to France was a gig with Radio France, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you about your work in radio, which is remarkable, both on the local level and nationally. You know, you worked for NPR as a freelance reporter. You appeared on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, all the big NPR shows.
Right. And I was a newscaster. Actually, I was hired as a newscaster, but I also did freelance reporting for them. Yeah.
Right. And here locally, you have an equally amazing history. You worked for a station called WNTS, I believe.
I did.
And you were the first female sports director at a major media outlet at the time. Is that right?
Right. Well, actually, before that, I had been at TLC.
Mm. You were at WTLC in the early days of the station.
Right. When Frank Lloyd, just after Dr. Lloyd bought it, and he and my mother got this together, which is the way it happened back in those days. And I had come back to Indianapolis to have my daughter, and I was working on TLC 2 months after she was born. So it was great. And
you were a news person at TLC,
I was
right?
The morning news anchor on WTLC. And I'm trying to remember the name of the DJ for whom I did morning news. But it was great fun. And I had worked as a for WNBC in New York. That was my part-time job while I was in Juilliard.
You taught Swahili on the radio,
oh,
right?
Oh, Lord, you've done your research.
I was going to ask you about that. That sounds so remarkable to me.
Well, it was 1968. I was... or 69, and I was trying to be hip, and I was taking Swahili just sort of casually, but the day before I would have a Swahili lesson, and the next day I'd be repeating it online at WNBC, and finally, one day after we'd been doing this for a while, I said, well, for those of you who'd like to know what you've been hearing and what you would like, if you'd like, I'll do a brief overview of what we've done. 4,000 postcards came in saying, please send us what you've been doing. Mm-hmm. And so WNBC went, oh, well, okay. So they all of a sudden one day I saw my, but the fact that you can learn Swahili on WNBC, tune in. And I went, ooh, okay. But it was all by happenstance. If I'd tried to plan this out, it never would have happened.
So your initial entry into radio was through your mother's association with WTLC. Do I have that right?
No.
Nope.
WNBC in New York.
WNBC was this. Okay, yes.
I was working as a part-time news assistant in the morning for the morning show, Joe O'Brien show. And they kept saying, wow, you have such a great voice. Why don't you say something? And so I started saying something, but I was working in the newsroom, and I was working at NBC in 30 Rock, and you know, Chancellor John Chancellor.
John Chancellor.
See, the mind is a terrible thing to waste. John Chancellor, David Brinkley, all the major names in news were down the hall. And I got a chance to learn from them about what do you do? How do you tell a news story? You have 30 seconds. Tell it. You know, get it right. Tell the story. So I learned from there. So I learned on the job, if you will, at NBC. And then the opportunity at TLC came about when I came back to Indianapolis. And because I'd been on WNBC, I was able to move into doing TLC. And then I went to National Black Network for a short time in New York, and then came back to Indianapolis to WNTS, the first radio station of
Jeff Smolian?
Yeah. So we call him media mogul now. That's what Letterman calls him.
Yeah. And you were on the air with David Letterman, correct?
I was. I was.
Yeah. And he had a running joke where he would refer to you as Jane Pauley's sister because
twin sister.
Yeah, names are pronounced.
That's right. And then he would say, their mother is so proud.
Yeah.
And Jane, and when David sees Jane occasionally now, he'll say, how's Claudia?
Yeah. Did you find that humorous?
I did.
Yeah. Was he difficult to work with? He seems like he would be kind of unpredictable, difficult.
Well, he could be unpredictable, but he was never difficult with me. He was just David.
I don't know if this is true, but I heard that you and David were on air with the Grand Dragon or whatever they call them of the Ku Klux Klan. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was just me actually. Yeah. We had set up the producers had set up an interview with the Grand Dragon, and because, yes, and he agreed to it. I did it, and I tried to keep my cool until the interview was almost over. And then I said, now, as one of those, and it was something akin to jungle bunnies that you've just been talking about, I'd like to thank you very much for this interview, whatever. And there was dead silence. And click. And then the callers came in. We didn't know you were black. You don't sound black.
Wow.
And but it was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing because I don't know if you knew where WNTS was, but
no.
NTS was down in Beech Grove, not a particularly black neighborhood.
Yeah. especially back then. Yeah.
Especially back then. And the listeners just didn't know I was black. And so to find that out, and neither did the Grand Dragon either, but he did at the end. And but it was pretty good. I felt fairly righteous after that.
That's good. And you got a lot of attention for being the sports director at this station, right? I think you appeared on the Tom Snyder Show at one point about it.
Right.
Yeah, tell me about – you were a real trailblazer in local media and maybe national media too, I guess.
Well, I guess because I was one of the very first women to go into locker rooms. And the reason I did – here in Indianapolis with the Pacers, and I did because of Tom Binford, because at that point, Tom was being the general manager of the Indiana Pacers right after the Simons brought it. And Binford was just brilliant. He was a brilliant man anyway, and he was a man who's always been grounded in equality and fairness. And because he was with the Pacers and that he was also chief steward at the 500 at the same time, and so I wanted to go cover the 500. And so I was the first woman to have a silver badge, which is the badge that lets you go anywhere at the track. And this was 1974. Yeah. So, and it was Binford that did it.
I mean, do you still get recognition for that? It seems like something that you should be in the Indiana Journalism Hall of Fame for this.
No, because I didn't stay in journalism. Okay, yeah. That would have been, if I'd stayed in journalism and only done that, that would have been fine. If I didn't run off to Paris for the next 4 years, I perhaps would have been. But no, it was just, it was part of what I did.
And Claudia, I believe the final chapter of your career in radio was with National Public Radio, right? Was that the last sort of...
That was.
Opportunity you had in radio. Do you want to say anything about your time producing content for National Public Radio?
It was wonderful. It was intriguing. It was challenging. It was also in some ways disappointing because I had always wanted, thinking that, wow, all these very hip, intellectual, thoughtful people would be just amazing to work alongside. And for the most part, that was the way. But it, this was the late 80s. A number of them, they couldn't understand why, one, I didn't talk black, and two, I had just moved back to the United States from France, and I spoke French fluently and had a pretty good accent. Another good part of being a musician is that you have a decent ear. There were a couple of times when there were interviews with French folks that people couldn't conduct, and I said, well, I speak French. I'm happy to help. And they wouldn't let me do it. Mm. And it was just... They didn't think that black folks had the same experiences that they did. And one was about Fox Lake and my family's having a cabin on a lake since before I was born, that they didn't understand how that could happen. And that's when I realized it was time for black folks to tell the story of their history, not let anybody else do it.
That's disappointing to hear. And I think NPR is only starting to kind of gradually change that kind of behavior. What kind of stories did they want you to cover? Just things related to African-American issues and...
Actually, I was the one that offered stories to them, and they said yay or nay.
Okay.
So the stories I did were of my own choosing, and so I went out and either sometimes with a sound person, sometime on my own. One of my favorites was doing a story about... Jesus Bikers. What was the name? But we're for Jesus Bikers, and we were going around Southern Indiana on bikes, and people said, "You have lost your mind." And initially, I was going to go with a friend of mine on the back of the bike with him, but he it turned out he had something else to do, so he just said, "Here, take the car, go." And but it was a great story. Bikers for Christ was the name of the story, and that was a great one. I also did another one about the black movies being produced in Hollywood because this was 1991, and so many black directors. Coming to the fore, and it was great to do that. So it's when I got to meet John Singleton and Bill Duke and a bunch of folks. Unfortunately, John's not with us still. Bill is. And a couple of us, Reggie Hudlin and his brother. But it was just a golden time. But it was stuff I got to think up, then pitch to NPR, and then they let me go do it.
And speaking of directors, Claudia, your work in radio, I believe, led you to become a director of documentary films. Is that correct?
A producer.
I'm not good enough to be a director,
but I am good enough to be a producer.
You made some pretty significant local and national projects. I think you were involved with a film, From the Mind's Eye, about, they call them folk artists, outsider artists, however you want to phrase it.
Right.
You interviewed Purvis Young, who's a very profound a visual artist. Yeah. Tell me about your work in filmmaking.
Well, that was a video documentary that we did for the Museum of American Folk Art. And this was, must have been 93, 94. And From the Mind's Eye was specifically a story about Henry Darger,
who
incredible artist. When we walked into his apartment in Chicago, you were immediately in Henry's world. Mm. And it was a little eerie, but it was extraordinary. And I'm pretty good at setting a scene. So as a producer, I was good. The art historian that we were working with, who knew Darger's work from top to bottom, was also a great partner in all of this. And then the Museum of American Folk Art was delightfully the place where we got to show this. And you're talking about Purvis, yes, and
yes.
Talking about other outsider artists, and now it's not called outsider art because there's the annual fair each year in January in New York, which has become one of the preeminent art fairs anywhere. And in fact, I've just officially moved back to Indianapolis, so I have more stuff than I can ever imagine. And there are boxes, and most of the boxes are filled with books. And one of the boxes I opened this morning, and I had two beautiful books about Bill Traylor, a black...
Drawings, incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
good. I'm so glad you know of Traylor.
Yeah.
And it just threw me right back to the time of getting to know Bill Traylor and being involved in that world.
Wow.
And there's, everything you do, you hopefully learn from. Mm. And then not only the important part now and what I'm doing is not only do I get to learn, but I get to share what I learn so that other people are knowledgeable about people in place.
Just a quick question about Henry Darger's art. You know, now he's like a big cult figure, and there have been subsequent films made about his work. When you were involved in this project, he was virtually unknown, I think, outside of the art world. His work is frightening and eerie.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
Frightening and eerie.
Yeah.
but to have that kind, what was going on in his head, then to translate it into the art that we see, which is troubling, but it's also an extraordinary vision into another dimension that one person had, but probably he was not by himself, although Henry did live entirely in his own world. It was troubling, but it's good to see. And he took us into his world so utterly, completely.
We've been listening to Claudia Pauly discussing her work in broadcasting and documentary film production. Let's pause and listen to a unique jazz recording featuring Claudia on vocals. In 1994, Claudia performed on an album with the jazz legends Clifford Jordan and Rand Blake. The album was titled Masters from Different Worlds, and we'll hear a track from that recording now. This is Wives and Lovers. Echoes of Indiana Avenue will return with more words and music from Claudia Pauly after this short break. This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. This is the final episode in our two-part series with Claudia Pauly. During the late 1980s and 90s, Claudia worked as a producer for the jazz label Maple Shade Records. During her time at Maple Shade, Claudia produced several classic jazz and blues LPs, including albums from legendary artists like Gary Bartz, Leon Thomas, and Clifford Jordan. Up next, we'll listen to music from a pair of classic blues albums Claudia produced for Maple Shade. First, we'll hear Archie Edwards singing John Henry. After that, we'll listen to Sonnyland Slim performing Got to Get to My Baby.
John Henry walked into that big, big tunnel. His captain was by his side. There rocks all tall, John Henry.
That was Sonnyland Slim with Got to Get to My Baby off his 1995 album Live at the DC Blues Society. That record was produced by our guest this week, Claudia Pauly. She recently spoke with WFYI's Kyle Long. Let's return to their conversation as Claudia discusses her work producing music for Maple Shade Records.
You were involved in some records, jazz records, by musicians who I idolize. I think you produced a record by Leon Thomas and Gary Bartz, and you sang on a record, if I'm not mistaken, by Ram Blake, who's
yes.
a pianist who
oh.
made some incredible records with Gene Lee in the 1960s.
Absolutely.
Tell me about your work in jazz music.
Well, I was partnered with Pierre Spray, who was the founder and head guru for Maple Shade Records in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, and so Pierre was this audio genius and only did high quality audio recordings. And what I produced with Maple Shade was done in our living room. It was a big old colonial manor house. And so most of the time the musicians stayed in the house. We fed them, we recorded them, we would get up, and whenever we wanted to get up, we'd record whenever we wanted to record. My Alaskan Malamute, Buck, became the studio dog, and he would walk in the middle of a session with Ran and company and just sit down under the piano. Everybody kept going, and he was the studio dog, but that was my, and that's where the great teaching of and the learning experience of being a good musician, hopefully, came into play. And so I got to edit the recordings to turn them into final recordings, final presentations, what you hear on Maple Shade Records. And first we were doing stuff with Musical Heritage Society, which I don't think still exists, but we did it for MHS and then we did it for Maple Shade. And unfortunately, Pierre passed this last year, but we managed to turn out some good stuff while we were together.
Let's pause and listen to another classic recording Claudia Pauly produced for Maple Shade Records. From 1987, this is Leon Thomas and Gary Bartz with Cousin Mary.
See to the room.
That was Leon Thomas and Gary Bartz with Cousin Mary. That recording was produced by our guest this week, Claudia Pauley. Let's return to our conversation with Claudia as she discusses her latest project, ULI, the Urban Legacy Lands Initiative.
Claudia, you've excelled in so many areas of life. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, falling into it. Yeah. I'm lucky. I mean, I'm just lucky. And the thing is to be prepared.
Right. Know. The final kind of area of your work I wanted to ask you about is preservation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you mentioned, this goes back to your mom and the Indiana Avenue Association of the 1960s. You're now involved with the Urban Legacy Lands Initiative,
yes,
which is a historic preservation project. And this is work you've been doing here in Indianapolis at least since the 1980s, I think, with the preservation of Fayette Street during the construction of the canal downtown. Tell us about, you know, your history of working in historic preservation here in Indianapolis and how that relates to what you're doing today.
Well, it comes from my work actually at NPR and my, I won't say chagrin, but my, I was offended by the comments that I was getting from my NPR mates about their lack of knowledge about the black middle class. Not so much that there were blacks who had some money. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was more money than some people had. And the generations of culture and education and similar activities to what these kids were used to, going to boarding school and then off to their family's summer houses and then off to, you know, top-notch Ivy League schools. Well, I didn't go to an Ivy League school, but some would call Juilliard an Ivy League school in a different genre. And I went to prep school and I went to, you know, this, that, and the other. And they did not understand that. And I said, okay, stop being mad with them. Start telling the story. So in 92, when I came back to Indianapolis, and because we had been living in Lockerbie Square, my mother was one of the first people to buy a home and renovate it in the new Lockerbie Square, if you will. And that was 1972. Mom bought a 15-room house for $5,000 and right on Park Avenue, right in the heart of Lockerbie Square. We thought she had lost her mind. But it turns out that she had not, and she loved old houses and she wanted to save it. So after 15 years or so, she realized that why am I staying in Lockerbie Square when there's this area that her family, my family, had come to in 1904, which we now call Ransom Place, which was slowly but surely being destroyed. And she said, no, we need to go in and do something. So she started doing that in 1991, 92, as I came back to Indianapolis and was at NPR and went to the National Preservation Conference and working with Reed Williamson, who was then the president of Historic Landmarks of Indiana, which was its name at that point. And he said, well, why don't we do something? Why don't we try and get it together? And the Canal Coalition, we had the whole issue with the impending destruction of what was left of Fayette Street. And we convinced Steve Goldsmith, who was then the mayor, that we needed to save those two blocks of Fayette Street that remained. And we formed the Canal Coalition and got it together. Goldsmith was smart enough to say yes, and Landmark bought up houses that were elsewhere, sitting by themselves, moved them into the empty spots on Fayette Street to repopulate an historic district. And now you have that beautiful area of Fayette Street, small but still there, which gives which commemorates the neighborhood that used to be there. Mm-hmm. Actually, the neighborhood is still there, but there was a much larger neighborhood that was there, and it's truly, truly amazing. And we were able to do that. And my mother had started Ransom Place when she bought her house, her cottage on Camp Street. When we first saw that house or pictures of the house, as Mom said, the only reason this house is still standing is because the termites are holding hands. And that was pretty much the case. But she turned it into a beautiful little spot, and I'm lucky enough to be back in it now.
Anything you want to say about the work you're doing today with the Urban Lands Legacy Initiative?
Yeah. Just that it is for us to tell the story. And we are working on the protection, as I say, the mission statement is to reveal, protect, and preserve the rich heritage of Black people and places. And so we tell our story, we protect those places, not just for Black people to live in, but to have anyone who respects the history of the place to be there and to be part of the community, that is. We start with historic Indiana Avenue and also historic Fox Lake, but we're looking to work in other neighborhoods on the near west side, which are under threat of just not being treated with this respect they are due. Let's just leave it at that.
You know, finally, this neighborhood, Indiana Avenue, or in Black neighborhoods in Indianapolis in general, the history in these neighborhoods has either intentionally or unintentionally, so much of it has been destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. The physical presence of these buildings is largely gone on Indiana Avenue. What do you make of that? What is your sort of personal reflection on the destruction of that history?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't stand up to make sure it did that. Did not happen. So, but we can bemoan what didn't happen 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago. But what do we do about it now? And I guess that's kind of been the way I live my life. You know, I'm really sad that certain things did not happen. So what do you do to make the best possible future? And that's what ULI is about, is making sure that the future shows the respect of the people in place that were there before. Work towards that. And there are lots of other people that want to do that. They just hadn't had anybody come along and say, hey, let's do it together. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I'm not doing this by myself. Mm-hmm. I am old and crotchety, so I need good folks to be beside me. And this is for my kids' generation and actually my grandson's generation. This is their future, and they need to know what came before.
And I asked David Williams this question recently, and I think you might have a different answer, and I'm curious what you might have to think about this. Do you think there can be justice for what was done? Do you think there can be justice in the future for these neighborhoods and the Black community that have been destroyed?
I think there can be justice. I think by telling the story accurately and well and not allowing any more to be destroyed or removed, that's the justice for the past. The injustice is to stand back and not do anything.
That was Claudia Pauley sharing her thoughts on the legacy of Indiana Avenue. We'll end this week's show with another classic disco track Claudia released during her time in France. From 1979, this is It's Not Time to Say Goodbye. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for tuning in for the second episode of our two-part series with Claudia Pauley. You can meet me here on the Avenue again next week, same time, same place. And you can find the Echoes of Indiana Avenue podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcast. Echoes of Indiana Avenue is written and produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Herman Butch Slaughter.
Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do. Nobody knows on uptown, baby.